I called a travel agent in Bellevue and visaed a ticket to San Jose. I skipped email and tried to focus on the overnight stress tests, but my mind was blanking. Two code breaks overnight, so close to shipping, and we're still getting breaks. I tried roaming the corridors for diversion, but somehow the world was different. Micah was in Cupertino with my luggage. Abe wasn't in his office. He'd bailed out for the day and gone sailing in Puget Sound with some richy rich friends. Bug had gone into a crazy mode since breakfast and had a Get Lost post-it note on his door, and Susan was at home for the day preparing for the Vest Fest. And the one other person I wanted to see, Carla, wasn't in her office. The day then degenerated into a $1,000 day. That's what I call the kind of day where even if you tell all the people you know, I'll give you a crisp new $1,000 bill if you just give me a phone call and put me out of my misery. Even still, nobody phones. Went home early at 5:30 and nobody was there. Susan had two card tables unfolded in the otherwise empty dining room area, awaiting their snacks. Abe had loaned Susan his sacred Dolby THX sound system for the party, plus his two Adirondack chairs made from old skis. The place looked a bit bare. It was like the day without people. Around dark, things started hopping. Abe returned from sailing and cranked up old Human League tunes, to which he sang along from the shower. Susan returned with bags of food from the caterers that I helped her carry in and set up. Pasta puttanesca, Thai noodles, calzones, Cheetos, and jerkins. Bug and some of his bitter, nutcase friends arrived with a wide selection of beer, and they were in good moods, sitting around playing peanut gallery to hard copy and A Current Affair, being amusing and eating half of Susan's party food while she was dressing. By 8 o'clock, other guests had begun arriving, bringing bottles of wine, and by 9 o'clock, the house, which not 2 hours previously had been a pit of gloom, was brimming with good cheer and you too. Around 9:30, Susan was talking with her friends, telling them that she'd vested just in the nick of time. I've been switching from a right lobe person to a left lobe person over the past 18 months, and I couldn't have gone on coding much longer. Anyway, I think the era of vesting is coming to a close. The phone in my room rang just then. We have 9 lines into our house. Pacific Bell either loves us or hates us. I excused myself to answer it. It was Mom. Apparently, Dad had just flown up to Seattle from Palo Alto on impulse. She'd just gotten in from her library job and found a note on the door. I asked what time his flight landed, and she told me he was arriving at the airport as we spoke. So I went and sat on the curb outside the house. It was a bit chilly, and I was wearing my old basketball varsity coat. Carla walked up the hill from her place, said hello, and sat down beside me, carrying a 12-pack of beer that seemed enormously large for her small arms. From my body language, she knew that everything wasn't okay, and she didn't ask me anything. I simply said, "My dad's just flown up here. He's come unglued. I think he'll be arriving shortly." We sat and looked at the treetops and heard the wind rustle. She then held my hand, and we sat there together. We drank some of the beer she had brought, and we said hello to Mishka the dog, who cruised by to visit, then went for a nap under the trampoline. And we watched the cars that pulled up to the house, one by one, waiting for the one car that would contain my father. He arrived not too long afterwards in a rental car, piss drunk, not sure how he swung that, looking tired and scared, with big bags under his eyes and a bit deranged. He parked with a lurch right across the street from us. We sat and watched as he sucked in a breath and leaned back on the seat, his head slumped forward. He then turned his head towards us and through the open window said, a bit bashfully, "Hi." "Hi, Dad." He looked back down at his lap. "Dad, this is Carla," I said, still seated. He looked at us again. "Hello, Carla." "Hi." We sat on our opposite sides of the road. Behind us, the house had become a thumping shadow box of festivity. Dad didn't look up from his lap, so Carla and I stood up and walked over to him. And as we did, we saw that Dad was clutching something tight in his lap. And as we approached, he clutched it tighter. It seemed as though he was afraid we might take away whatever it was. And as we neared, I realized he was holding Jed's old football helmet, a little boy's helmet in gold and green. the old school colors. "Danny," he said to me, not to my face, but into the helmet, which he polished with his old man's hands. "I still miss Jetty. I can't get him out of my mind." "I miss Jed too, Daddy," I said. "I think about him every day." He held the helmet tighter to his chest. "Come on, Daddy. Let's get out of the car. Come on into the house. We can talk in there." I opened the door, and Carl and I both supported Dad on either side as he clutched the helmet to his chest, and we walked into the house, his appearance generating little interest in the overall crowd. We went into Michael's room, where we placed him on the bed. He was ranting a bit. "Funny how all those things you thought would never end turned out to be the first to vanish. IBM, the Reagans, Eastern Bloc communism. As you get older, the bottom line becomes to survive as best you can." "Well, we don't know about that yet, Daddy." I pulled off his shoes, and for some time Carl and I sat beside him on two office chairs. Michael's machines hummed around us, and our only light source was a small bedside lamp. We sat and watched Dad filter in and out of consciousness. Went into the office and played Doom for an hour, deleted some email. There were soggy maple leaves all over the Hornets sport about this afternoon. The orange colors were dizzying, and I must have looked like such a space case staring at the car for 15 minutes, but it felt so relaxing. Cleaned out the kitchen cupboards, read the phone book for a while, read a Wall Street Journal, listened to the radio. Carla's been living here for 3 weeks, and I'm not sure I'm not going to screw things up. It's all so new. She's heaven. Imagine losing heaven. Wednesday. Todd and I tied our Ship It Awards to a rope behind my AMC Hornet Sportabout hatchback wagon and dragged them for an hour around the suburbs of Bellevue and Redmond. Net result? A few little nicks and scratches. They are awesomely indestructible. Dad phoned to ask me how to hook up a modem. He's joining the net now. For 3 days last month, he ended up on the velveteen green living room couch, sleeping endlessly. Or else he'd come sit with me in my office while we finished debugging for shipping. He seemed to like that, but he was so fragile. And when Carl and I drove him out to SeaTac Airport, he sat in the back seat, rattling like a stack of Franklin Mint souvenir plates. Mom keeps sending me clippings about the information superhighway and interactive multimedia. She clips things out of the San Jose Mercury News, her librarian's heart. The highway. Is it a joke? You hear so much about it, but really, what is it? Slideshows with music? Suddenly it's all over the place. Everywhere. Bug sulks in his room all day, listening to Chet Baker, restoring his antique Radio Shack Science Fair 65-in-1 electronic project kit and memorizing C++ syntax. Susan house hunts. Todd lives at the Pro Club Gym. Abe has been reassigned to a subgroup in charge of designing a toolbar interface. Woo-hee! I think Abe's being punished for going sailing that day with his friends during the week we were all in crunch mode. We don't see him much. He's back in Microsoft Time Space again. He gets home late, feeds his neon Tetris sprinkles of ground-up, freeze-dried poor people, chides us all for not exhibiting more enterprise, and then sleeps. 2:45 a.m. Drove into Seattle tonight with Todd in separate cars. Todd scored at the Crocodile, and at the moment, he and his date, Tabitha from Tukwila, are currently in his room getting acquainted. Thursday. We ripped away some wallpaper in the kitchen by the fridge and found that underneath the various stratum of paper, daisies, peel, and stick peppermills, in condition just as fresh as the day they were written, the words, "One mellow day, June 6th, 1974. I'm long gone, but my idea of peace now remains with you. D.B." Hippie stuff, but I lost my breath when I read the words. And I felt like, for a moment, that maybe an idea is more important than simply being alive, because an idea lives a long time after you're gone. And then the feeling passed. And we found all of these old early 1970s Seattle newspapers behind a wallboard. The prices back then, cheap. Friday. Random day, fed on magazines for a while, radio, phone call from mom. She talked about traffic. Radio, phone call from mom. She talked about traffic. Saturday. Oh, God. I knew I'd do something. Carla's on the warpath because I forgot our one-month anniversary. Oh! She gave me until bedtime tonight to remember, but I still forgot, so now she's not speaking to me. I tried to tell her that time isn't necessarily linear and that it flows in odd clumps and bundles and clots. Well, what exactly is a month, Carla? Ha-ha-ha. I don't know about you, Dan, she interrupted, but I programmed my desktop calendar to remind me. Good night. Insert one frosty glare here, a bored yawn, a bedroom door nudged closed with little baby toes. It's nice to see this romantic side to Carla's personality, an unexpected bonus. But still, nobody likes the couch. And so now, after weeks of blissful insomnia-free sleep, I'm yet again power-booking my daily diaries here on the acid-green couch in a big, big way. Tomorrow, I will program my desktop computer to remind me of every one of our anniversaries, monthly or otherwise, until the year 2050. Actually, we all have so much free time now. Carla, Todd, Bug, and I sit around awaiting our next product group assignment, feeling deflated and just plain exhausted. We forget about clock and calendar-type time completely. Yes, Carla moved in a month ago. We are an item. Todd, Abe, and I lugged her ownables from her geek house down the street up to our own geek house at the top of the cul-de-sac. Futon and frame, cluster O computers, you frame it, Ansel Adams print, and dumped it all into Michael's empty room. And then, once she installed herself in our house, think of me as a software application. She announced that she was an expert in, thank you, Lord, shiatsu massage. Mom phoned this afternoon. Out of the proverbial blue, she said to me, the house. The soil up in the hills is settling and the roof's rotting. The door and windows need replacing. I just stand here and feel the money being sucked out of my body. At least we had the foresight to buy it when we did. But all of my librarian's salary goes into the house. The rest goes to priced Costco. Money. I changed the subject. How's Dad doing? Prozac. Well, something like Prozac. At least he doesn't obsess on the garage anymore. He goes out in the morning, I don't know where, looking for work. Let's not get into it. God, I wish I drank. Life is stressful in Palo Alto. I send Dad $500 every month. It's all I can spare on the $26,000 I make here. $26,000 divided by 12 minus taxes equals $1,500. It was a really bad phone call, but Mom just needed to vent. She has so few ears in her life who will listen. Who really ever does, I guess. Michael never did return from Cupertino. Rumor had it Bill had Michael secretly working on a project called Pink, but nothing ever came of the rumor. A delivery company specializing in high-tech moves carted Michael's things away to Silicon Valley. His pyramid of empty Diet Coke cans, his suitcase of Habit Trail gerbil mazes, his collection of C.S. Lewis novels, gone. Fun fact, we found about 40 empty cough syrup bottles in the cupboard. Michael is a Robitussin addict. Actually, he bulk buys knockoff house brands. He's a Payless Tussin addict. The world never ceases to amaze. It's late at night, basketball on TV, computer and fitness mags everywhere. Let me talk about love. Carl and I fell in love somewhere out there. I think that's the way it happens, out there. The two of you start talking about your feelings, and your feelings float outside of you like vapors, and they mix together like a fog. Before you realize that the two of you have become the same mist, and you realize you can never return to just being a lone cloud again because the isolation would be intolerable. Carl and I would talk about computing and coding. Our minds met out in the crystal lattice galaxy of ideas and codes, and when we came out of our reverie, we realized we were in a special place, out there. And when you meet someone and fall in love, and they fall in love with you, you ask them, "Will you take my heart, stains and all?" And they say, "I will." And they ask you the same question, and you say, "I will too." There are other reasons Carla's lovable too. Reasons not so poetic, but just as real. She's like a friend to me. And we have all these common interests, mind meld, whatever. I can discuss computers and Microsoft and that part of our lives. But we also have esoteric conversations that have nothing to do with tech life. I've never really had a friend this close before. Anyway, I want to remember that love can happen, because there is life after not having a life. I never expected love to happen. What was I expecting from life then? As I type this in, I feel small arms around my neck and a kiss on my jugular, and I don't know, but I think I may be forgiven. I hope so, because my forgetting the anniversary thing was an honest mistake. I'm new at this love thing. Sunday. Todd's obsessing on his body big time these days. This afternoon he came in from the gym and sat on the living room Orlon carpet, flexing his arm and staring at his muscles as they bulged, buff and bored. His biggest project at the moment is making pyramids out of his empty tubs of protein supplements with their gold labels that resemble Van Art from the 1970s. Why do nerds make pyramids out of everything? Imagine Egypt! The Cablevision was out for some reason, and Todd was just lying there, flexing his arms on the floor in front of the snowy screen. He said to me, "There has to be more to existence than this, dominating as many broad areas of automated consumerism as possible. That doesn't seem to cut it anymore." Todd? This speech was utterly unlike him, thinking about life beyond his triceps or his supra. Maybe like his parents, he has a deep-seated need to believe in something, anything. For now, it's his bod, I think. He said, "What we do at Microsoft is just as repetitive and dreary as any other job, and the pay's the same as any other job if you're not in the stock loop. So what's the deal? Why do we get into it? What's the engine that pulls us through the repetition? Don't you ever feel like a cog, Dan?" Wait, the term cog is outdated, a cross-platform, highly transportable binary object. I said, "Well, Todd, work isn't and was never meant to be a person's whole life." "Yeah, I know that, but aside from the geek badge of honor stuff about doing cool products first and shipping them on time and money, what else is there?" "I thought about this. So what is it you're really asking me?" "Where does morality enter our lives, Dan? How do we justify what we do to the rest of humanity? Microsoft is no Bosnia." "Religious upbringing." Carla came into the room at this point. She turned off the TV set and looked at Todd square in the eyes and said, "Todd, you exist not only as a member of a family or a company or a country, but as a member of a species. You are a human. You are part of humanity. Our species currently has major problems, and we're trying to dream our way out of these problems, and we're using computers to do it. The construction of hardware and software is where the species is investing its very survival. And this construction requires zones of peace, children born of peace, and the absence of code interfering distractions. We may not achieve transcendence through computation, but we will keep ourselves out of the gutter with them. What you perceive as a vacuum is an earthly paradise, the freedom to, quite literally, line by line, prevent humanity from going non-linear." She sat down on the couch, and there was rain drumming on the roof, and I realized that there weren't enough lights on in the room, and we were all quiet. Carla looked at me. "Dan, let's go out and get a Grand Slam breakfast. I have $1.99, and it's burning a hole in my pocket." Susan quit the day she vested and began running with the wolves, or so she announced to all of us the morning after the Vest Fest. She unveiled her new image as we were sitting in front of our Mitsubishi home entertainment totem, eating our last few boxes of Kellogg's Snack Pack with plastic spoons, deconstructing old Samson and Goliath cartoons, and trying to figure out how, if, to wake up my dad, who was still passed out on Michael's bed. Susan's previous image, Patagonia-wearing Northwest Good Girl, had been shed away for a radicalized look. Bent shades, striped fortral too-tight top, Angela Bowie hairdo, dirty suede vest, flares, and Adidas's. Wow, said Bug. What a stud. She stormed past us, stopped at the top of the stairs, said, fuck it. I'm tired of being Mary Richards. I'm off to hold up a 7-Eleven, and then clomp down to the driveway. I think she expected us to be a bit shocked. But, you know, it's actually really great when a person reinvents themselves. We finished our Fruit Loops and soy milk. Todd came up to me later tonight and said, Dan, I wouldn't fuck around so much if I could meet somebody like Carla. This freaked me out, and I got this awful feeling, which I think is jealousy, but I can't be sure because it was a new feeling, and nobody ever tells you what feelings are supposed to be like. But Todd saw this and said, that's not what I meant, Dan. I'm not going to jump her. Give me some credit. But man, where do you find somebody like her? Yeah, she's something else, I said blandly, masking my interior burn. She's so smart, but not just coding smart. She thinks like a preacher, but not a by-the-books preacher. She believes in something. Monday. Melrose Place night tonight. We double-clicked onto the brain candy mode. We're all addicts. We like to pretend our geek house is actually Melrose Place. Tonight, Abe said, I wonder what would happen if we all started randomly going non-linear like the show's characters. What would happen if our personalities became divorced from cause and effect? We could take turns going psycho, said Bug. Susan, writing the words Duran Duran on the metatarsals of her fingers, said, You already are psycho, Bug. That doesn't count. I called to see if Mom was feeling better, and she was. She signed up for swimming classes at the local pool. But the big news occurred when Dad got on the extension line and shouted at me, I'm employed! Way to go, Dad. I told you something would come up. What are you going to be doing? Oh, this and that. Michael is certainly one bright young fellow. Odd, but bright. You're working for Michael? I certainly am. At Microsoft? No, he's starting something else, a new company. He is? What are you working on there? Shock. And he's living in one of the spare bedrooms. Can you believe it? Good God! Yes, I can. And your job description? Here, your mother wants to speak to you. Mom chatted about being relieved with Dad's salary plus rent money flowing in, but the job description never arrived, nor any clue about this mysterious new company. So Dad's working for Michael. Michael's hiring people. That is so random. The world is indeed chaotic. Tuesday. A FedEx pack arrived today with letters for everybody. Michael's offering all of us jobs at a startup company he's assembled down in Silicon Valley. Excerpts from Michael's letter. People our age are abandoning the tech megacultures in droves, starting up their own companies, or joining small content-based startups. There's a recruiting frenzy going on, multimedia craziness, and the big companies that aren't minting money are hemorrhaging brains. It's intellectual Darwinism. The five of you are rudderless at the moment. Is now not the time to take a risk and jump into the future? Let me simply say that history is happening. It's happening now, and it's happening here in Silicon Valley and in San Francisco. Tell me, are you seriously going to be at Microsoft 20 years from now? 15? 10? 5? Or even 2 years? At what point do you decide that you have to take your own life into your own hands? At the very least, you'll make an okay salary if you work with me. At best, you'll gain equity in something that might become very valuable. I have an idea for a product that I think will be very popular. And wouldn't it be amusing for all of us to be together again? I must have your decisions immediately. Do call, most definitely yours, Michael. Michael has designed this amazing code, and the scary part is completed already. The proprietary work that could only have sprouted from Michael's brain, object-oriented programming. And he's been doing it in his spare time as a game called Oop. He offered me a job coding, as opposed to just testing. Who knows how long it would take me to move up to coding at Microsoft? He sent us a rough draft of a product description he's written, plus engineering requirements specifications, herewith. Oop is a virtual construction box, a bottomless box of 3D Lego-type bricks that runs on IBM or Mac platforms with CD-ROM drives. If a typical Lego-type brick has 8 bumps, an Oop brick can have from 8 to 8,000 bumps, depending on the precision demanded by the user. OOP users can virtually fly in and out of their creations, or they can print them out on a laser printer. OOP users can build their ideas on a pad, or they can build their ideas in 3D space, a revolving space station, running ostriches, whatever. OOP users won't have the actual plastic blocks in their hands. OOP generates new experiences to compensate for this lost tactility. Feedback loops, hidden messages, or rewards for properly completing a kit, i.e., King Kong will climb up and down your Empire State Building and install the flag if you finish. OOP comes equipped with starter modules such as houses, cat shapes, cars, buildings, and so forth that can be added onto or modified or finished in an unlimited number of colors or surfaces, slate, leopard skin, wood grain, and so forth. OOP structures can grow hair or plant life. OOP structures can be distorted, stretched, morphed, or jelloed. OOP users can dissolve the connection lines between bricks to create solid structures. As the LEGO generation ages, and as the OOP product invariably grows more sophisticated, OOP becomes a powerful real-world modeling tool usable by scientists, animators, contractors, and architects. Object-oriented programming design allows great flexibility for licensees to develop cross-platform software add-ons. Build every possible universe with OOP. We felt surreal about Michael's offer. At sundown, we congregated in the living room, turned off the ESPN2, cracked open 2 Safeway fire logs, and chewed over Michael's data. We talked some more, but the basic idea was clear. As Abe said, it's virtual Lego, a 3D modeling system with almost unlimited future potential. OOP sounds too fun to resist, like that pile of free birdseed in the old Roadrunner cartoons, said Bug. Susan said, maybe OOP is sea monkeys. Maybe it seems unbelievably fun, but in the end winds up as a cruel, bitter letdown upon arrival. I doubt it, said Abe. Michael's a genius, we all know that, and the ERS looked great. Just think, said Carla, Lego can be rendered into anything. In 2 or 3 dimensions, this product has the possibility of becoming the universal standard for 3D modeling. We silently nodded. And we didn't talk much. We just looked into the flames and thought. Mom called. She's learning the butterfly stroke at 60. Carla kept on talking about bodies, her obsession, tonight. About an hour ago, before she fell asleep, and I, as ever, remained wide-eyed and awake. When I was younger, she said, I went through a phase where I wanted to be a machine. I think this is one of the normal phases that young people go through now, like the Lord of the Rings phase and the Ayn Rand phase. I honestly didn't want to be flesh. I wanted to be precision technology, like a Los Angeles person. I listened to Kraftwerk and Cars by Gary Numan. A concerned pause. Oh, is your foot twitching, Dan? Let me fix it for you. Insert foot massage here. That was a decade ago, and years have passed since I had that particular dream of wanting to become a machine. Then 4 summers ago, when I was visiting my parents down in McMinnville, I accidentally fell back into the body-machine dream. It was a summer day, too bright out, and I was walking amid the family's apple orchards and developed a brain-splitting, wasp sting of a headache and became nauseous. I walked into the house and went into the basement to be cool, but I threw up on the cement floor next to the washer and dryer. I lost control of my left arm, and then I passed out on top of a stack of laundry for 3 hours. Dad freaked out over the paralysis and drove me into the city, and we did a brain scan to check for stroke damage and clots and stuff. They injected all sorts of isotopes into me, and I found myself part of a literal body-machine system, being bodily radioactive, and inserted like a fuel rod into a body scanning machine. I remember saying to myself, so this is the feeling of being a machine. I felt more curious about death than I felt afraid. I felt glad to be no longer human for a few brief minutes. Was there a blood clot, I asked? No, simple sunstroke. And the feeling of my being a machine evaporated quickly, too. But the whole incident made me decide to discover my body pronto. Here, she said, scratching my tender inner forearms lightly with her fingernails, sending me into paroxysms of delight. How does that feel? Just as I thought. People who do repetitive work on keyboards tend to have highly erogenous forearms and shoulder cuffs. Now you scratch me. I did. And then we scratched forearms together, and I felt like two of us were in a nature documentary on mating African veldt animals. Of course, she said, you'll have to learn all of this stuff, and you're going to have to reciprocate on me. Body 101, sign me up now. Wednesday. Bug ranted a bit about Lego in the afternoon while we ate arrowroot cookies and bounced on the trampoline. The air was cold and our breath visible. We were all wearing laundry day junk clothes and we looked like scarecrows flailing about. Why are we all so hopeless with our bodies? Bug said, you know what really depresses the hell out of me? The way the kids nowadays don't have to use their imagination when they play with Lego. Say they buy a Lego car kit. In the old days, you'd open the box and out tumbled 60 pieces you had to assemble to make the car. Nowadays, you open the box, a whole car, pre-fucking built, pops out. The car itself is all one piece. Big woo! Some imagination challenger that is. It's total cheating. I got to thinking of my own Lego superstitions. When I was young, if I built a house out of Lego, the house had to be all in one color. I used to play Lego with Ian Ball, who lived up the street back in Bellingham. He used to make his house out of whatever color brick he happened to grab. Can you imagine the sort of codes someone like that would write? I used to build with mixed colors, said Bug. What do I know, I said, pulling my foot out of it. Carla cut in. I had this friend Bradley who had a major Lego collection, and I'd cheat, lie, and steal to go to his house and play with it. Then one day, Bradley's mother put his Lego in the bathtub to wash it off. It was never the same. Diseased. Sort of stinking. Like the water was turning into feta cheese inside the plastic tubes of the locking devices. I think his memories of Lego must be pretty different from my own. Bug said, for designing games, Lego makes a great quickie simulator for figuring out mazes for gaming levels. You've designed games before? I asked. I've done everything you can do on computers. I'm 31. Maybe we underestimate Bug. When I stop and think about him, he's so full of contradictions, it's like there's one big piece of him that if I only knew it, it would make sense of everything. Since Michael's offers came in, we've all become really quiet. I've noticed. We're all mulling it over. Our doors are closed, phone calls are being made to the 415 and 408 area codes. Carla says we're all trying to figure out what we really need in life, as opposed to what we simply want. A weird shiatsu moment. Carla focused on a piece of my chest just above the xiphoid process, that weird thing in the middle of your ribs, and bang! Out of the blue, I started bawling. I couldn't stop. So I guess I have memories hidden away that I don't think about. Thursday. A random sort of day. Woke up late. Went on a CD rampage at Silver Platters in Northgate, bacon burger at the IHOP. Carla taught me some shiatsu basics, pressure points and stuff. Massage is a two-way street, mister. I've been with Carla way over a month now, and just when I'm starting to understand her, something happens that makes me realize I don't. One truly weird thing about her is that she never calls her family or talks about them. All she'll say is that they're psychotic, as if everybody's family isn't. Friday. Carl and I discuss what we're planning to do. We don't have much time to choose. Michael needs a response by the end of this week. Michael is offering me a 24K salary plus 1.5% of equity, as opposed to my Microsoft 26K plus 150 shares vested over 3.5 years. Plus the opportunity to be a coder and be closer to Carla on the food chain. And even best of all, the opportunity to be with Carla in the same product group again. Saturday. It was another rainy day that called for a fire. We'd most of us spent the day processing all of our new career option data. We ran out of fire logs and had to light a real fire with flammables culled from around the house. A brawny paper towel carton full of junk mail and bits of furniture too ugly to even throw out. Sunday. Bug is going to accept Michael's offer. This is out of character, given that Bug worships Bill and the corporate culture of Microsoft so much. But he seems quite jolly and decisive about the move. I think the fact that he was slated for transfer to the Converter Group in Building 17, a notoriously glum campus locale, added some oomph to his decision. Bug is a good debugger. That's how he got his name. So Michael's probably getting a good deal in hiring him. I still can't figure out why he never got stock options. Todd, too, has decided to go, perhaps also propelled by his transfer to the OLE group. This is the Object Linking and Embedding group that writes code for an application allowing a user to drag part of, say, an Excel document into a Word document. About as much fun as it sounds. Susan's accepting, and she's forking up some of her vesting money as seed capital for a larger equity stake. And she's clinching the title of creative director. Abe, however, is saying no. What, you guys want to leave a sure thing? He keeps asking us. You think Microsoft's going to shrink, or are you nuts? That's not the point, Abe. What is the point, then? 1.0, I said. What? Replied Abe. Being 1.0, the first to do something cool or new. And so in order to be 1.0, you'd forfeit all of this? Abe fumbles for le mot juste and expands arms widely to showcase a filthy living room covered with Domino's boxes, junk mail, solicitations, Apple hard hats, 3 Federal Express baseball caps, and Nerf Gatling guns. How do you know you're not just trading places, coding like fuck every day except with a palm tree outside the window instead of a cedar? Monday. Abe has actually provoked Carla and me into deciding yes. We both gave our 2 weeks' notice, and they basically said we might as well leave at the end of the week since we're not currently with Project. With startups, you get a crapshoot at mega equity, but more importantly, it's true. You do get a chance to be 1.0, to be the first to do the first version of something. We had to ask ourselves, are you 1.0? The answer is what separates the microserfs from the cyberlords. Thursday, later that week. Preparing for this week's yard sale, I found a half-pound lump of hamburger meat in the garage that had been sitting in a Miracle Whip jar for about 4 months, an experiment I had forgotten about. The meat was still kind of pink with gray fuzz growing on it. A test to see if the beef industry pumps up cattle with preservatives, I told Carla. She looked at the jar. Your brain, she said dismissively, during the last half year at Microsoft. Mom phoned. She sounds so much better now that the economic stress is off her and that she's exercising. After a short while, I got to asking what it is that Dad does for Michael exactly. So what's Dad's job, Mom? Well, I'm not sure. He's never here. He's driving with Michael up and down the peninsula, picking things up, fixing up the office, I think. Carpentry? In a whisper. Well, it keeps him out of my hair all day, and he seems happy to be needed. Resumption of a normal tone. So when will we be seeing you down here? Next week. Saturday, garage sale day. It was a real Zenothon. We decided the time had arrived to shake ourselves of all our worldly crap and become minimalists, or at least try starting from scratch again. More psychic pioneering. This is so Zenny, Bug said happily as some poor cretin purchased his used electric razor. Ugh! As well as his collection of Elle McPherson merchandise. The big surprise? Everyone sold everything. Everything, even the box of styrofoam. Bug's right, we are one sick species. And my car sold too, in a flash, to the first person who came around to look at it. Wayne's World did wonders for the secondary market of AMC products. Now I am virtually possessionless. Having nothing feels liberating. Sunday. Today we left for California, and Carla did her first major flip out on me. I suppose I was being insensitive, but I think she overreacted by far. In packing her microbus, she buried all of the cassettes we were going to be using for the trip deep inside the bowels of luggage. I said, "God, how could you be so stupid?" Then she went crazy and threw a toaster oven at me and said things like, "Don't you ever call me stupid, and I am not stupid." And she piled into the van and drove off. It was too bizarre. And Todd, standing nearby, just shrugged and went back to bungeeing his solo flex on top of his Supra. I had to take off in the Acura and catch up with her down by the Safeway, and we made up. Bug was like a little kid, all excited about our convoy down to California, and was romanticizing the trip already, before we'd even left. The worst part was he had his ghetto blaster on and was playing that old 70s song, Convoy, and so the song was stuck in our heads all day. Somewhere near Olympia, Bug's car rounded a bend, and it was so weird, gravity pulled me into an exit off-ramp, and then everyone else trickled in too. Served him right for lodging the virus of that dopey song in our heads. It was like in third grade when you ditch someone. It just happens. Humans are horrible. Then we all felt horrible for ditching Bug, and we went out chasing him. But we couldn't find him, and I got a speeding ticket. Karma. I-5 is radar hell. During a roadside break, I asked Carla why she didn't want to go visit her parents in McMinnville, but she said it was because they were psychotic, and so I didn't press the matter. We found Bug south of Eugene. He didn't even know about the ditch, so now all of us have a dark secret between us. Psychosis! We were discussing Susan's new image at dinner when I told Carla about this really neat thing Susan's mother did when Susan was young. Susan's mother told Susan that she had an enormous IQ so that Susan could never try and pretend she was dumb when she got older. So because of this, Susan never did feign stupidity. She never had any fear of science or math. Maybe this is just the roots of her whole riot girl transformation. On hearing this news, Carla went nuts. It turns out that Carla's parents always told her that she was stupid. Everything in life Carla had ever achieved, her degrees, her ability to work with numbers and code, had always been against a gradient of her parents saying, "Now, why'd you want to go filling your head with that kind of thing? That's for your brother Carl to do." "Carl's nice, and we like each other," Carla said, "but he's a total 100, center of the bell curve and no way around it. My parents drove him crazy expecting him to be a particle physicist. All Carl wants to do is manage a Lucky Mart and watch football. But they've always refused to see us as we are." Carla was off and running. Here's an example. Once I went home to visit, and the phone was broken, so I began fixing it, and Dad took it away and said Carl should give it a try. And Carl just wanted to watch TV and couldn't fix a phone if it spat on him. And so I was screaming at my dad. Carl was screaming at my dad, and my mom came in and tried to discuss women's things and dragged me into the kitchen, meatloaf fucking recipes. Carla was just fuming. She can't bring herself to forgive her parents for trying to brainwash her into thinking she was dumb all her life.